you, Shelley. It was a lot different than the last reading I think we had Shelley do, which was about 700 Old Testament names, one after the other. So well done. Good job. I think I was here last week or the week before, and someone came up to me and said, I have a confession, Ben. I watched a movie that you told us not to watch when you were up here preaching one time. And I'm like, oh, what movie was that? And we went on to have this conversation. And I'm like, that, I don't even know why I would have said don't watch that movie. It's only rated like PG or something. It was probably just to cover my butt, so save your cards and letters kind of thing. And so I said, don't watch this movie. So I'm going to refer to another movie, and I'm once again telling you not to watch it, and probably some of you are going to do so. I don't know if you've seen the movie The Usual Suspects. Don't watch it. It's one of my favorite movies. Don't watch it. One of the reasons why I love The Usual Suspects is because there's this amazing plot twist that happens in it, and it catches you completely by surprise. The Sixth Sense is like that as well. Don't watch that one either. It's, you know, we love plot twists. We love following along with the story, carrying certain assumptions about the characters that we are getting to know, and then finding out, I was actually wrong. You're not who I thought you were. Something similar is happening here in the Gospel of Matthew. So let me catch you up on where we have been in the last few weeks, and then let me explain where the plot twist is taking place. We've been looking at the big picture of Matthew, the big picture of the story Matthew is telling. And in his opening chapters, he's focusing on the fact that Jesus is a king. That's why we have the royal family tree that comes up at the beginning, the genealogy. I didn't have Shelley read it. We had someone else read it instead. But we had this genealogy that someone read out here, describing one ruler after another after another. This is Jesus' family tree. It is a royal family tree because Jesus is the rightful king. He is the son of David. And that is connected to the hope of the Old Testament. The hope of the Jews was not just that they would have a king and once again be independent. They wouldn't have Babylon or Rome or the Egyptians or anyone else ruling over them. They would once again be independent. But that was only the tip of the iceberg. They were hoping that in their independence, this king would become the rightful ruler of the world. That's actually the way that God had designed the Old Testament hope to be fulfilled, that the Jewish king would be the one to whom the other nations, the Gentile nations, the people who do not follow Yahweh, would come and they would pledge allegiance to the rightful Jewish king. They would pledge allegiance to Yahweh himself, and they would follow after Yahweh. We're going to hear about some of that hope being connected to our story here this morning. The hope of the Old Testament is for cosmic salvation. And cosmic salvation, as in not just dealing with sin problems, but dealing with systemic evil. All evil. Everything that went wrong in Genesis 3 is going to be undone by the hope by this Jewish king. And that's what that is the story that Matthew is starting to tell us. So that's the hope. But there's a plot twist. See, Matthew has set up those expectations. They're the ones that he inherited, and they're the ones that are going to be fulfilled. But the plot twist here comes when we realize what this king actually looks like. This is not the king that we were expecting, because they were expecting someone who looked like Caesar. They were expecting someone who looked like David, who conquers his enemies. And they're not going to get that. So the big picture, Jesus is king. Matthew here in chapter 2 is going to start filling in the details. What does this king actually look like? And the plot twist is that we are not going to get the king we expected. So, Matthew's going to do that by contrasting Jesus, the rightful king, with Herod. Herod is a different type of king. Herod is actually not a king by birth. I don't know if you know this or not. Herod was one of Caesar's henchmen, essentially. He was a hired gun. He's just a random guy who rose up through through Caesar's armies, and he becomes a military commander. And at some point, Caesar says to Herod, "You help me succeed in this particular war, and I will make you king of a particular territory." Herod does so, and the kingship that he inherits is this kingship, king of the Jews. He gets this particular area. Herod is actually not even Jewish. This king of the Jews here that we're being told about is an Edomite. He's from Edom. They call them Idumeans at this point in the story. But Herod is not Jewish. We have an imposter here on the scene. He's one of Herod's hired guns. He has become essentially a puppet king. He's going to rule this particular area, but he's ruling it under the authority of Caesar himself. He works for someone else in charge. That's Herod. And Herod gets some visitors coming to see him, these magi. The magi are Gentile astrologers. What do we mean by astrologers? They're people who read dreams. They're people who read stars. Think of Daniel. You know the Old Testament story? Daniel actually becomes a type of magi, and that is how he functions in the Babylonian kingdom that he's been placed in. So Daniel interprets dreams. The other magi, they read stars. They're trying to then advise the kings. So that's why they end up getting called wise men, because they're in a position of some sort of education. They think they have inside knowledge into the how the stars are affecting world events, and so they advise kings. They're called wise men. And these people epitomize everything that Judaism stood against. Everything. So think about this. They're Gentiles, which makes them unclean, according to Jews. They worship idols. And Jews, as you move from Old Testament to New Testament, are starting to understand that when you worship idols, you're not just worshiping this innate object, you're starting to worship the demons that stand behind them. So these are not just worshiping false gods, they're participating in demonic activity. That is how, and actually Paul references that in one of his letters, that behind the idols stand the demons. Okay, so these people are practicing dark arts. They're reading the stars. A cult is what we might call them today. And God meets them where they are. What do you think about that? What people today have practices and lifestyles that might make you or I think that they are beyond hope? Our job is not to change their lifestyle. Our job is not just to have disagreements and then leave it at that. Our job is to point them to Jesus. God meets these pagan magi where they are and points them to Jesus, and he meets them in their practice. They're looking at the stars, they're reading the stars, and God uses a star to point them to Jesus. Have you thought about that? In a sense, I don't really know what to make of that, but here's one possible suggestion. Perhaps we need to keep in mind that God is working in places that we don't expect, where we wouldn't even think that God would touch that situation with a 10-foot pole. This is the God we worship, who is involved in things far beyond what we expect. And he's pointing people to Jesus. I think that's awesome. So these magi, they've been reading the stars, and somehow in their reading, they discern that a Jewish king has been born. So they make the trek all the way, they make it west, all the way to the place where the Jews live. And they go and they knock on the door of the person that they are expecting has just had an heir born to the throne. They're going to see Herod, right? King of the Jews. They're expecting to find Herod's child has been born. That's not what they find. And Herod is scared. And notice, it's not just Herod that's scared for himself. It says, and all Jerusalem with him. Everyone is panicking. There's widespread panic here. Do you know why there is widespread panic? Because there's another king being claimed that is claiming the throne. That's scaring them to death because they are afraid that Rome is going to come in and crush something. Because the Jewish people have this history, you know, this history that I just described, this Jewish king, he's going to take the throne, he's going to rule over the Gentiles. That story that these people live with is causing constant tension among the Jewish people. There are constant revolts in Palestine because there are people essentially claiming to be king. Other would-be messiahs. Jesus is not the first or only person to claim messiahship. He's not the only one to claim to be king. And it threatens the people who are in power. Herod actually brought relative peace and stability to that area because it was a volatile area. And Herod is now worried, and all of Jerusalem with him, about another potential insurrection and what Rome might do about it. They don't want any more crosses outside the city. So what does Matthew want us to hear? First of all, I think Matthew wants us to hear that God might be at work outside of his people. Second, I think Matthew wants us to hear not only that Jesus is king, but that there are echoes of that bigger story of the Jewish king who will rule the Gentiles and bless the nations. Think Solomon. It's a picture like Solomon. Do you remember that story about Solomon? Who comes to see Solomon and bring him gifts? Queen of Sheba, right? Gentile. We're seeing something similar happening with this Magi here. Matthew is gesturing towards these Old Testament stories. But notice that this king, this Jewish king, is a threat to the wicked kings who are in power. And you know what, friends? He is still a threat to anyone who uses power in a way that is not in service of others. He is. And there, notice also that there are now only two responses to Jesus. Offerings, offering of worship and gifts, or Herod's response, rebellion. So notice Herod's reaction. How does Herod react? He freaks out. He's protecting himself. He's probably trying to protect the wider Jewish people as well. But he freaks out. And we have this slaughter of the innocents, is what it has been called. Some babies take it. Some babies are killed. He wipes out anyone that he thinks might be this potential king who has been born. Herod was not the most stable person to begin with. I don't know if you know this or not, but Herod actually killed his own wife and several of his children because he was worried that they were a threat to his throne. So this is completely in keeping with Herod's character. This is the guy that we are dealing with here. So he's protecting his throne. He's protecting the peace. That's his job. Just like that's Pilate's job. You know, we're seeing the same thing. Pilate, Herod, they both report to Caesar. They both have a job to do. Keep the peace. Don't screw up. And that's what Herod's going to do. He's going to make sure he maintains the peace. Let me ask you, though, why is Matthew telling us this story? Matthew is the only gospel writer who includes this story about the children being killed and about Herod in general, this particular part of Herod in general. Why is he doing it? Matthew is not just reporting on history. Matthew has an agenda. I want to suggest to you that this picture of what happens between Herod and the children is a picture of what happens when human autonomy has its own way. When people get into power and they do not use it in a way that God wants them to use power, vulnerable people get hurt. I think Matthew includes this story because this is one more illustration of absolutely everything that Jesus has come to change. So let me ask you, who are the vulnerable and the oppressed and the marginalized people today? And how are we going to respond to them? What about the LGBTQ+ community? Are they vulnerable? Have they been oppressed? And do we need to apologize for some things, for the way that we have reacted to them? What about Aboriginal people, First Peoples? What about addicts? What about refugees? We don't have to agree with another person to help them. Jesus, known as a friend of sinners, right, spent most of his time hanging out with people he didn't agree with. And that's how they changed. What do I think Matthew wants us to hear? Like I said, I think Matthew is giving us a picture of what needs to change and what happens as a result of human autonomy. Human power without service for others is dangerous. Human power in self-service means that vulnerable people get hurt. How are we going to use the power that we have in service of the vulnerable and the marginalized and the oppressed, whether or not we agree with them? I think this slaughter shows why he came. I think that's why Matthew mentions it. Now, the family manages to escape. They go down into Egypt. I have a picture of an Egyptian refugee camp up here. Jesus and his parents flee for their lives, and they go to Egypt to claim refugee status. Do I really need to make the parallel today? Like, I would almost be insulting your intelligence, but I'm going to for the sake of making sure no one misses the point here. What about the refugee crisis going on here? The Holy Family showed up at Egypt's border as refugees. So let me ask you, do you think they were welcomed? Do you think that the locals griped about how it might affect the local economy? They might take a job, might otherwise have gone to a local? Or did they say, hey, it's our privilege to share what we have been blessed with. Yeah, we can help you out. Do you think that some local people there might have taught them the language, might have given them shelter, might have helped them find work, might have worked with them and supported them as they cried because they missed their families and they didn't fit in? Do you think that some of God's people there might have done that? I hope so. I hope so. I probably also don't need to point out that the Bible actually commands that refugees be looked after. Old Testament language tends to use words like resident alien or stranger or sojourner or foreigner, depending on the translation that you use. But let me suggest that these are all different categories of people who are marginalized and vulnerable and powerless. And the Bible tells us not only not to oppress such people, but then actually gives commands for us to make provision for them. So let me give you an almost just random example. You'll see it on the screen. This is Moses speaking to the Israelites who are about to enter the promised land. He says, when you reap your harvest in your field and forget a sheaf in the field, don't go back and get it. It shall be left for the alien, the orphan, and the widow, the people who are vulnerable, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all of your undertakings. When you beat your olive trees, do not strip what is left. It shall be for the alien and the orphan and the widow. When you gather grapes of your vineyard, do not glean what is left. It shall be left for the alien and the orphan and the widow. Three times in three verses. Three different groups of people, the most vulnerable, the most powerless, and marginalized. And God makes sure that his people know that it's going to be part of who they are, that they look after such people. In other words, all that you have is not yours. All that I have is not mine, even in a recession. The family stays for a little while in Egypt. And then out of Egypt, I call my son. We're going to deal with that fulfillment language next week. There are a number of fulfillment things that happen here. We're going to talk about that next week. They go to Nazareth. Nazareth. This is Joseph's hometown. You might want to call it Podunk. Seriously. Nazareth, as far as biblical scholars are concerned, they think that it was about all of 50 to 60 acres. We're talking small. 480 people, they guesstimate, lived in and around Nazareth. Jesus grew up a hick from the sticks, friends. Seriously. Jesus didn't just minister to marginalized people. He was one of those marginalized people. Jesus grows up a hick from the sticks. In fact, the people who lived in the cultural Jewish centers of power, like Jerusalem, used to mock the people who lived in this area because they had what they thought were funny accents. They weren't cultured. They weren't smooth talkers. They weren't educated. They're country bumpkins. That's Joseph. That's the Jesus who is about to minister to people. Picture, modern example, picture a slow-talking Texan with a southern drawl talking to, you know, power brokers in New York City, and you'll get something of the picture going on here. No offense to our American friend over there. As one of you once told me, where are you from? Oh, yeah, that's a good place to be from. Thank you very much. That's sort of like Jesus' upbringing. It was a good place to be from. As in, you didn't want to stay there. You didn't want to grow up there. So what does Matthew want us to hear? Our Jesus had absolutely no status at all. He was poor and he was marginalized. In fact, one contemporary biblical scholar wrote a book. It's like 5 volumes long. I've never read any of it because I hear it's just so tediously boring. But the title of this book, talking about the historical Jesus, is known as, he called the book A Marginal Jew. A Marginal Jew. That's the Jesus that you and I follow. A marginal Jew. Second thing I think Matthew wants us to hear. This king is not going to rule from a position of power. So we need to pay very, very careful attention to how Jesus uses power and what his relationship to power and status is. Because Jesus doesn't come change the world by legislating change or using the power that he has to make change happen. At least not in the way that we would expect Caesar or Herod or someone else to make change happen. The Jews are expecting a conqueror. They are waiting for someone to give Rome the boot. And they get Jesus, a hick from the sticks with no power at all. Jesus is going to continually reverse people's expectations. He's going to minister as a peasant. So we need to think very, very carefully about how we think our world is going to change. Because you talk to some evangelicals, and they think that, from the way that they speak, it's as though they think that what we just need to get the right person in power, the particular party that we want, and the world's going to change. Like, that's just not how Jesus uses his power. What are we going to do with that? We sometimes treat mayors and presidents and prime ministers and so on like they're the next Messiah. But look at the way that this Messiah operates. A marginalized Jew ministering at the margins. And that is what changes the world. Not trying to get more power for ourselves and then legislating certain behavior. Jesus identifies with the marginalized and the oppressed and the disenfranchised. What do our followers need to do to look like him? What do we as followers need to do to look like him? We started by reminding ourselves of the big picture. Jesus is king. Matthew, I then suggested, takes chapter 2 to say, what exactly does this king look like? He's a peasant king. Backwater town, funny accent, on the run with a price on his head. He's a refugee. So our theories about power and leadership and status need to change. This challenges our expectations about how God is going to change the world, because he's not going to do it through Herod or Caesar or someone who looks like him, whether that's a modern-day CEO or the next prime minister or president, as we'll find out next month. It is the exact reverse of all that. It's a plot twist. This is a refugee king. So to close, I'm taking a page out of Weird Al's book, And my friend Peter up the road, actually, my friend Peter up the road at was it New Life Community Church, he said every once in a while he writes a poem to close off his sermon. So I thought I'd write more of a parody of What Child Is This? And I'd like to leave you with it. So, what child is this who laid to rest on Mary's lap is screaming, whom pagans greet with gifts so sweet, while Herod and co are scheming? This is Christ the King, whom Joe will shortly need to spring. Haste, to Egypt flee with colicky Jesus the refugee. Why goes he to a foreign state where chariots are speeding? Oppressors fear, for Jesus here brings empires down by bleeding. This is Christ the King, a fugitive, poor and suffering. Haste, this truth to mine. At immigration, they stood in line. So keep your gold. Hey, what is myrrh? These peasants here can't use it. The King of Kings, no bling he brings. At customs, he would lose it. This is Christ the King, to whom we'll soon be answering. Haste, to bring him laud, the immigrant child, the expat God. Raise a song on high, from home our Jesus had to fly. A marginal Jew, if you please, identifies with the least of these. Let's pray. Lord, we are humbled by the humility you demonstrate, by coming in humble circumstances and powerlessness to rescue us from every oppressor and oppression. Forgive us for the ways that we trust more in the ways of Caesar and Herod than in your way of changing the world through suffering and service from the margins and among those marginalized. Give us your grace to help us follow you there. Amen.